And we're actually small enough today that we might get to hear people's names. Is this too loud? Kind of loud. I'll just whisper. It's very loud. So this module is kind of loud.
I can't talk normal.
Can I turn? Okay, that's a little bit better, maybe. Okay. All right, so welcome to the Discovering Buddhism. This module is on developing bodhicitta. And last week we defined bodhicitta. It's two words. Bodhi meaning awakened. And what we're talking about being awakened from is ignorance. And citta meaning mind. So it's the mind that's awakened from ignorance. And we'll talk a little bit. We'll go back and review some of it. But I just wanted to give that basic definition. And I'll clarify a couple of things that we talked about last week, which will help kind of catch everybody up. But first, let's start, as we always do before a practice and before these classes, with a short meditation and setting our intention and our motivation for what we're about to do. You know, whether you know it or not, you're setting your motivation before most of your activities. This is just going to be much more consciously. So even before our negative activities, you know, there's some kind of intention or motivation. Juries try to figure out what people's intentions and motivations were. And so what we're trying to do before something as positive as this is really think about our intention and fine-tune it. So first, just get into a comfortable meditative posture. And again, the most important thing is that your back is straight, as though it were coins stacked on top of each other. If you're sitting in a chair, then your feet are flat on the floor. You can place your hands, the right hand just gently on top of the left hand, thumbs just gently touching as though holding a small piece of paper, and place that below your navel. Arms out away from your body. Tuck your chin a little bit so that your neck is also straight. Relax your jaw. Put the back of your tongue against the top of the back of your teeth. So there's a little space between your teeth. You're not clenching unconsciously. And then put all of your awareness on your breath, on the inhalation and exhalation, the sensation of air coming in and out of your nostrils. And as you exhale, imagine that any discomfort, any worry, any extra thoughts, all the stuff from the day just leaves you in the form of smoke going way out to the ends of the universe. And then when you inhale, imagine you're inhaling pure golden white bright light. You can imagine that this is the white light of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, holy beings, whatever. You're inhaling it and it's filling every cell in your body. And then exhaling everything you don't need. And inhaling that purity. Just do that for about 5 breaths. And then take a moment to think about why you came. Maybe it's curiosity, you want more information, sounds like a good idea, something to help you become calmer, wiser, more loving, whatever the reason. And then try to expand it, especially since we're talking about bodhicitta, which is the intention to help others. Think about how you can help others. Think about generating the intention and the wish that this meditation, that this practice, that this study change your mind. And as your mind changes, all those around you, those you know and those you don't know, are affected. And as we talked about last week, it's important to set your intention in the beginning, the middle, and the end. So we start with a very strong intention that everything we listen to, everything we share, everything we're thinking about will accumulate and become part of that which becomes our awakening. Okay, and then open your eyes. So is this term bodhicitta a brand new term for anybody? Because don't be shy if it is. Even though I've heard it for a long, long time, I always have to go back and kind of regroup with it, because just being human, something kind of starts to, you know, I can get very excited about it, and then something kind of comes in to take all that shine off, and then I've got to go back and kind of remind myself, what is this? This is really amazing. This is just amazing that I'm able even to hear this word, to study this, to understand this, to think about it. So before we go off onto that a little bit, I wanted to clarify some things I was talking about last week, because I gave you either half information probably half of the information that I really needed to give you. So we were talking about the two kinds of bodhicitta. And you'll hear a lot of different people talking. There's lots of different ways to categorize it. The way you'll hear a lot is relative and ultimate bodhicitta, kind of like the two truths, conventional or relative bodhicitta, and then ultimate bodhicitta. And ultimate bodhicitta is usually referring to when the understanding of emptiness, when realizing emptiness, is conjoined with bodhicitta. So that wisdom realizing emptiness and the pure altruistic compassion of bodhicitta are joined together. But both of them are bodhicitta. And one of the things I've talked to Geshe-la at length about this, you can achieve bodhicitta before you realize emptiness. You can realize emptiness before you achieve bodhicitta. So, you know, they don't automatically come together, but when they do come together, it's like, you know, an atomic bomb just went off in your mind. So ultimate, though, is the bodhicitta conjoined with emptiness, wisdom realizing emptiness. And then there's, you know, there's all these different levels of that. So it gets really, really complicated. I'm trying to make it as simple as possible. So these two terms you will hear about, though. And then relative bodhicitta, conventional bodhicitta, can be further divided into two kinds, aspirational and active. And aspirational, we talked about last week about how if I want to go to New Orleans, and because I'm going to New Orleans next week and I'm driving there and I'm making all these plans, I have the wish to go. I have the wish, I'm making the plans, I'm getting everything ready, I rented a car, I've told my family there I'm coming. So, you know, that's aspirational. However, the thing that I want to clarify is that even that, the person's already achieved bodhicitta. So even the aspirational, this isn't somebody like me. I have the wish to have bodhicitta. I don't have it 24 hours a day. If you really have achieved aspirational bodhicitta, that wish alone is so powerful in your heart that it's affecting everything. And you might have to encourage it so that it doesn't weaken, but it's not something you have to generate all the time. And then active bodhicitta is putting that into action. So you have the wish, and now you are doing concrete things, and those concrete things are in the category of the six perfections. So if some of you, some of these terms are new, I apologize. You'll hear them a lot, so I want to at least introduce you to them. And the six perfections are often thought of as the six perfections, the six actions of a bodhisattva, mastering those perfections. And so it's not just like me doing something generous. It's not, I was making sure that I really understood that. Like when I practice generosity, it's not that I'm practicing the perfection of generosity. I'm practicing generosity and it's a good thing, but I'm not a bodhisattva. When a bodhisattva practices generosity, it's again like generosity on steroids. You know, it's just boom. So the six perfections are the perfection of generosity, the perfection of morality, the perfection of patience, the perfection of joyful effort, the perfection of meditative concentration, and the perfection of wisdom. And then you can read all about those too. I'm just, again, introducing. And some of you already have in other classes here or at the center. But so I just wanted to make sure I gave you all the correct information. So relative bodhicitta, conventional bodhicitta. And the other thing Geshe was telling me is that like when a bodhisattva is, a bodhisattva might try to generate more compassion for beings in the relative way they'd be doing that by meditating on the sufferings of all beings that we all have in common, all the kind of traditional sufferings that we have based on our daily life. It's easy to see. When a bodhisattva is generating compassion for beings in the ultimate sphere, they're thinking about the sufferings that we have due to our ignorance, due to the fact that we don't see emptiness yet. That kind of suffering, which is a little bit different than the suffering you can see when I, you know, fall down out there and cut my leg. That's different than the wisdom, than the suffering I might have because of my lack of wisdom. Make sense? So I don't know how helpful all that is, but it's part of the package. and you'll keep hearing about it as you go along, so it's important information. Okay, so If you're new to the whole Discovering Buddhism, there is a CD with readings, and I ask people to read the first two articles because it will give you a lot more information on bodhicitta. And if you're interested in that, there's a CD you can buy out there. If you're not going to be taking other DB classes and you want to get online and look at those, talk to me after class because there is a way for you to do that. And I found the first two articles really, really helpful. I don't know how many of you had a chance to read them, but I'd really encourage you to go and check them out. I'm just sitting here torn between whether to go in that direction or to ask you about your homework. So I asked everybody to go into a really crowded and uncomfortable place and test your patience. And, you know, the thing that I love about Buddhism and particularly about this topic is there isn't any one thing that you've already learned that doesn't apply to this. All the meditations and the teachings that you've learned on impermanence and on death and on patience and on mind training, they all of them are moving in this direction of awakening bodhicitta. I mean, they're all moving, so there's not any one thing that you haven't, that you've learned already that wouldn't apply. And then when you really look at it, every single thing that we're learning is about training our mind. And, you know, if we think of our mind as a river, because I always love that analogy, you know, it's this stream of consciousness and it's this river. And so when that river is roiling and active and flooding, all the inhabitants around it are affected. When that river is really calm and life-giving and prolific and fruitful, then all the beings around it are also benefiting, are affected. So then we're the keeper of the river. So then all of the teachings are about how to try to keep that mind state as calm as possible no matter what's going on for your benefit as well as for everybody around you. And we always have to remember that we're including us in all of this, that we don't start over there and forget over here because the river is going to become a little puddle. We have to constantly take care of that river, but with the intention of helping all those around it. Does that make sense? That's something that I can kind of lose sight of at time and forget, oh yeah, I've got to make sure I'm taking care of myself with the intention that that's going to benefit others. So it's all in transforming that intention. And that's a lot of what that first article talked about the importance of transforming what they're calling self-cherishing, which is just another term for selfishness, of always looking out for ourselves, which we do so that we can stay alive. It's a good thing. But how do we transform that? And it's through that intention. How do we transform that self-cherishing so that it's also including all those around us? And that's not easy, but that's part of the key. So there's a lot of talk in that first article about that. So the homework was to go into one of those challenging places and find, you know, what would help you, since what I'm saying is that every single thing we've learned, there's some antidote to whatever mind state is bothering us at that point. I think some of the most important things I've learned is that's the key, is to work on training our mind, and that we can use everything. There's not something, okay, I've got to go find that book and what did I memorize and let me see how am I going to do this. We can use every situation to help us train our mind and develop our mind towards bodhicitta. So some of you may have remembered earlier classes where they talk about very first classes in DB, setting up the altar and cleaning the room. And that when you're cleaning the room, you're thinking about all the dust as not just dust. You're thinking about the dust as the results of like your jealousy or your anger or your negative actions from whatever past. And so as you're cleaning, you're thinking, yeah, I'm cleaning up all that negativity. Why? Because it conjoins some physical activity that you're doing with your thoughts. And it's putting that all together because you're trying to train your mind. And in that same vein, I don't know if you've heard Lama Zopa Rinpoche talk about, and it's in some of his free books on that shelf out there, that what he does, and it's just become his automatic habit, is anytime he does anything, say he opens the door, in his mind he's thinking, may I be able to open the door for all beings, leading them all to enlightenment. Raising up the blinds, may I be able to lighten everybody's life. You know, when you light a candle, may I be able to dispel the darkness of 1,000,000,000,000,000 worlds. So using everything, and that is aspirational bodhicitta. I mean, if you've really reached bodhicitta, then every single thing you're doing like that, you have that thought. So now the point is to try it, to practice with it. You know, as I was talking to Geshe-la yesterday, he said, there's no harm in pretending that you're a bodhisattva for a little while. What an amazing thing to do, because then you're trying to think like that all the time. And it would be starting to set that stage, starting to create those habits. So I had shared here last week about how I was in the airport. I'm not going to go through the whole story, but I was crowded and I was unhappy. And then I started just thinking of that each person who was coming out of the tunnel was in fact my mother who I was waiting for, and how that completely transformed my experience of being unhappy and in a crowded airport. And I really started to see each person coming out as precious. You know, and when someone's precious to you, you know, everything about them is so cute. And that it was just this mind-blowing experience of how, by myself, with just that thought, I changed my entire experience. And there's a million things like that to practice. And so I was encouraging people to go out and, you know, get in a long line at the grocery store, get into some traffic jam, and try it, or something like that, and see, bring it back and see what happens. So does anybody have anything they want to... Any successes or failures or notes from the field?
Should we use some
so far, there's not a problem. But do we need the microphone, guys? Everybody at home can hear the massive silence.
I have something.
Okay, great. Yeah, why don't you get a mic?
Because when people are at home, they can't hear.
Right, that's why we're using the mic, because most of us in here can hear it. It was frustrating. Yeah.
One of the things that I do this on?
Yeah.
One of the things that I do is to think of each person I see for a while. I try to keep that in my mind for a minute or two in the supermarket as perhaps being a Buddha,
mm-hmm.
or a bodhisattva, or here to teach me something. And then I could also go down the line of they've been my grandmother or whatever.
Mm-hmm. How did that work?
That helps.
Did it?
Especially if I think that they're the Buddha, because then I think of them as perhaps wise.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And that's how a Buddha would show up, perhaps, as somebody who's challenging us, who's, you know, cutting in line, it's not necessarily going to be this glowing person on a cloud, you know. It's going to push somebody who pushes your buttons, you know, can be your greatest teacher. Anybody else? Okay. Okay, great. I hear you.
Can you hear me now? Okay, so I'm tend to be a really organized person. So when I go to the grocery store, I have a list of everything. I know what I'm going to buy, and I'm out, I'm done, right?
Mm-hmm.
This Saturday, I was at the Harris Teeter in Cameron Village very early, and there was running to the soup line because it was buy two, get three free, and I was so excited I was going to get what I wanted. And I got there, and there were these two adorable older people standing there discussing with each other, well, if I get this one, which one are you going to get? And we're just going on and on and on. And normally I would just roll my eyes and go to another line and, you know, mm-hmm. get something else. And this time I just stopped. And they're like, well, we'll get out of your way. I'm like, no, I'm going to the same place. And I really like the clam chowder. What do you think about that? And,
uh-huh.
you know, it just
uh-huh.
kind of turned into a conversation. And I felt like, you know, it turned something that would normally make my head explode into really a pleasant experience.
And you see, what's amazing about that is you know your buttons, right? And so if you can catch it ahead of time, and you know when it's too late. And then you just kind of have to leave so you don't
right.
make it worse. But that's the whole point, is to kind of know yourself, know your button, and try to catch it before it arises. And, you know, when Geshe-la first talked about patience to me and years ago when he first came here, and he talked about it like stretching, you know, when you're sick and your stomach shrinks because you haven't eaten in a while, and then you start to slowly eat again, you can't do it all at once. You're just slowly stretching that. That's the same with us for our patience, our level of happiness, for everything. We've got to slowly stretch it, and we can. And then when you become happier and happier and happier and more patient and more loving and more compassionate, that's what people will be able to take refuge in. That's that river that's going to expand. It's almost like I catch myself sometimes thinking that it's just going to happen in some other lifetime. It'll just kind of descend upon me. No, it's not going to happen like that. It happens because we slowly, slowly, step by step, stretching our abilities and our capacity. And we're the only ones who can have the wish to do that. And then it just takes that joyous effort to take that real effort into working that program. Yeah, thank you. Any other stories? Well, I mean, I'd have to get you in little groups so you can talk, but I will do that soon enough. But that's going to be your ongoing homework, is to bring back kind of notes from the field, because there's plenty out there. And the more we hear what worked for other people or other places that you practice, the more you'll find yourself trying that as well. And the less I'll have to talk. And some of the things you're doing are actually the exact traditional meditations on this topic, which we're going to get into in a minute. So also in the article, I don't know if you... I don't know if it was the first or the second, but they were saying that, I guess it was the first, because it was Lama Yeshe, and he was talking about how busy we are here in the West, and don't beat yourself up that you're so busy you didn't have time to go home and meditate that day. And the easiest thing to do is what he called the lazy meditation, which is just go home and lay down and meditate and think about bodhicitta. You know, you can turn on the news, and, you know, Geshe-la and I were once watching the CNN Heroes thing. What an amazing thing. You know, it's this whole show where they're honoring different people who are doing incredible things. And so, you know, so you watch the news or you watch a show like that with kind of like your Dharma glasses on, and you rejoice in what other people are doing, and you're trying to look at everything from that lens. So it doesn't mean you have to go do something and really difficult. You know, it just means trying to see things through that frame of mind. I thought that was a great way of putting it. Does anybody have any kind of issue or question with this whole word self-cherishing? Because a lot of what they're saying in the article is, you know, that self-cherishing is the root of all of our unhappiness. And it's actually a quote I'm going to bring in and see if you all would like to memorize it, in the Guru Puja that talks about that, talks about how, you know, that's the source of all of our problem. Does that make sense? And not that's sort of all of our problem, but yeah, the self-cherishing mind is what generally in most situations when we're unhappy or uncomfortable or stressed out, that's what's going on. That's what's there involved in the picture. And so to try to look at that, really explore it for yourself, really take a look at that and see, is that true? And how would it change? And the trick, I think, is it's not about self-denial, right? So then how do I transform this self-cherishing mind into one that is cherishing others and not just denying myself? We could have a really good conversation about that. But I still think, it's not just that you think about it one day and then you've got it. You just have to keep going out there and looking and seeing, is this situation, how is self-cherishing causing a problem for me? You know? This is what I want, but maybe I can still get the soup. Maybe I can get the soup and come away with a really nice experience with these two people. Doesn't mean that, okay, I'm just not going to have soup, and then you walk away feeling even worse. You know, like I had to give up what I wanted so that they could get what they wanted, and that's really exactly what this is. You know, it's not that you become grumpier and unhappier, like, okay, I won't have the soup because other people are more important. It's about developing that joy. So I know Geshe-la's talked about when you really achieve bodhicitta, you go just from happiness to happiness. It's not about, and I showed him this documentary on Mother Teresa, and what he was saying after that is that, you know, she's not miserable doing these things. And a lot of people will say, oh, I'm no Mother Teresa, I'm no Gandhi. But in fact, what we're trying to say is, yeah, you kind of have those exact same capacities. You know, so it didn't just descend upon them. It didn't just fall on their head. And what is it that each of us can do to stretch that? Just thought of something and now I've forgotten it. So that she wasn't miserable. It's going from happiness to happiness, and so you're part of it. You're not separate from it. You're part of it, and people coming into it are feeling that. So if you watch, they had this wonderful documentary of Mother Teresa. Maybe I'll try to bring it in and show you parts of it. And some of the people who are coming up to her, they're just giddy just to be in her presence. She's not giving them anything. There's not anything, you know, she's not giving them $1,000 or much, maybe a little gruel, you know, that's about it. But they just can't wait to just stand in front of her. And Geshe-la was saying to me, and he'd lived in my house for 9 years and I was teaching him English, and his English was pretty different at that point. So he watched this and he asked me a couple of things. He's like, oh, is she Christian? I said, yeah, she's Christian. And he said, she's kind of ugly. And I said, well, probably not the right word. He goes, yeah, what's the other word? And he goes, well, she's not beautiful. I said, that's right. People weren't coming to her because she's beautiful. But she is beautiful. That's why people are coming to her. So he's trying to make this. And then he would talk in the center about this all the time. Like, if you just look at her, she's not the most gorgeous person on the planet. She's not the wealthiest person on the planet. But you feel something in her presence. And that's what people are enjoying. You know, and it's not her self-denial. It's her love. So, to me, it's just all about constantly reminding myself of that and constantly meditating on that, amazing what that is, and then seeing what can I do on a daily basis, just these little tiny things, sometimes getting that kind of joy just by thinking of some of the things I was telling you about, like opening a door, may I be able to do that, instead of some huge thing that I would bring in here and say, guess what I just did, I donated five whatever grand to this organization. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about how you can tame your mind so that others feel it. And you know it, you know, I think Thich Nhat Hanh has said everybody wants to do all these incredible things in their practice. He said, try changing your mood. That is a miracle. That is a miracle. And you know it. When you feel like you, before you tipped over into that difficult mood, you sat and you kind of watched your mind, and you thought about self-cherishing, and you worked with it. That is a miracle. And then, you know, you've just stretched something a little bit more. Okay, so let me talk about kind of the traditional way. As I told you last week, there's two main methods for developing bodhicitta. And one is called the seven cause and effect, seven causes, one effect method. And the other is called exchanging self for others, or giving and taking. So the seven cause, one effect, I'm going to go through the steps, and then we'll meditate on it, but there might be some questions about it. So the preliminary step, they're calling it the preliminary step, is equanimity. That all things, whether they're your friend, your enemy, or your stranger, that all beings are equal in wishing for happiness and wanting to avoid suffering. And there's lots of meditations on this. But anybody have any kind of fundamental questions or doubts about that? That's the way that we may have thousands of differences, and we're in all kinds of different circumstances, but that the thing that we have in common with even the smallest little bug is this wish to be happy or comfortable and the aversion to suffering. Does that make sense? And so that's a way to develop equanimity. So each of these builds on top of the other. So that's the preliminary. And then step one is recognizing that all beings have been your mother. Now, if you don't believe in reincarnation, even if you do believe in reincarnation, that's kind of a tricky one at times. If you do believe in reincarnation, then what you do is you think about how many countless past lives you've had in the past and in the future, and that in each of those lives, there's been a mother who gave birth to you. And since you've had countless lives, you've had countless mothers. And it's not going to be logical to think that the same handful of beings have been your mother. It's going to be just countless. For a long time, it was hard for me to really understand eons. You know, they talk about countless eons, and all I can really think about was, well, it doesn't seem like it'd be that long ago, you know, like when humans were first on the earth, and how many mothers would that have been, you know? But then I would read these texts where they would talk about, okay, an eon is the same as if a dove is holding a silk scarf and flying back and forth in front of a mountain, and the mountain dissolves. And that just didn't make any sense to me. I'm like, I can't imagine this dove flying back and forth. Or an eon is like, say, you take a little tiny grain of rice and you drop it into like a silo. And how many grains of rice that would take to fill that silo, that's like maybe one eon. And now we're talking about thousands of eons. So I finally, though, the more I read these, the more they finally started to sink in, and I started to read also just history of the Earth and other planets, and you know how long it takes for something to form and something to change, and so I kind of started to get it. Just started to feel the amount of time, and so we're just familiar with like the Earth, but that's not it. That's not just time didn't begin just with the Earth. So just try to let your mind keep thinking bigger and bigger and bigger when you think of like countless mothers, countless eons, countless time, and all the mothers you might have had. And so in that logical way, you can't probably even, you would never be able to count how many mothers you've had. And even if you could, you wouldn't be able to necessarily pick out which ones they were. So it's not going to hurt to think of every single person that you come in contact with as having the possibility of being your mother in a past life. And the reason for this whole contemplation is that first of all is that recognizing that all beings have been your mother, because that most people can generate some fondness when they think about mother beings. And if you can't, then you think of somebody else. So then if somebody else who is kind to you in your life, say it was an uncle, okay, then all mother beings have once been that kind uncle. You find what works for your mind. But when I say mother, that's why we're going with that. It's the person who's shown you kindness that's easiest to generate that feeling towards than to think that every being has been in that position to you before. So then step two is recognizing the kindness of the mother sentient being. And at minimum, this mother carried you inside her body and birthed you, at minimum. And so you can even just meditate on that. And, you know, all the meditations are not, are meant to have some real beneficial result. And you have to maybe tweak it or look at it from a different angle, but you're all wanting to go to the same place. So recognizing the kindness of mother beings. If it's hard to recognize that with your current mother, then you think about somebody who has been incredibly kind to you. The fact that we're all sitting here and we have this luxurious life to even think about these things means somebody has been really kind to us. So we think about that. And I remember one time, I can't remember if it was somebody in the class who asked it or somebody who asked me later, like, what about meditating on the bad things that my mother's done? I was like, well, what would be the benefit? You know, we kind of already do that. That's, you know, just bringing to, we do that. We already have already probably in our head a list, you know, a running list of things, wrongs. But that doesn't really usually get us anywhere. And so here's the time where we're going to meditate and familiarize ourselves. And I remember the first time I did this exercise, I picked a 1 year in my life, like when I was 8 years old, and I just thought about my mom when I was eight. And when I just focused on these amazing things she did, you know, she made my own clothes. I didn't really think about that too much until I did that meditation, like, oh, yeah. And she moved all of us as a single mother from this city to that city. And so I just was like amazed at the number of things that this person did for me. And that's the point, is to just fill yourself up with the kindness that mother sentient beings have given to us. So that kind of kindness then is what you're trying to think of with all the beings. Since all beings have been your mother, they've all shown you that kindness at some point. You know, watching nature shows and watching a mother raccoon taking care of her baby raccoon, it's inspiring, you know, just picking them up by the back of the neck and moving them over here and licking their little butt, and, you know, on and on and on. It's like, oh my goodness. I remember Robert Thurman saying he used to think when he would meditate on this and he would think about animals, he said, I could never really think about a crocodile though. Crocodiles, I don't think they care about their offspring. And then he saw some documentary where the mother crocodile was picking the baby crocodile up in its mouth and moving it somewhere, and he was just kind of blown away. So that's one of those lazy meditations you can do. That's a lot of fun. All right, so step three is repaying, then generating the wish to repay the kindness of all mother sentient beings. So now that you have gained an understanding of the kindness that they've shown you, now you contemplate how important it is not to ignore that kindness, but to repay their kindness in the best way possible. And think that you are in a specially fortunate circumstance because of them. But those fortunate circumstances allow you to be able to repay their kindness. You have met the Dharma. You received teachings from qualified teachers. You have all the right circumstances to practice, and therefore determine that you will do as much as you can to repay their kindness by liberating them from suffering and bringing them true happiness that they wish for. So again, all of this is about trying to generate that wish to get everybody out of prison. So last week I used this analogy, which I think is really helpful, and I encourage you to find the analogies that work for you. So the analogy is we're in prison. And if we were in prison, if this were a physical prison, we wouldn't have to think too much about wanting to get out. We would just be living that night and day. And then would we want to get others out of that too? If we developed some friendships there and everybody was going through the same thing we were going through, we'd probably want to get them out as well. And that's the same thing in terms of generating bodhicitta, knowing that this cyclic existence is a prison. And is it enough just to get out? If you were able to get everybody else out of that, all these mother beings who've been so kind to you, wouldn't you want to get them out as well? Think about times when you haven't had to work to generate that wish. I know when I was a kid, I was probably about 13, and this like electrical wire hit our apartment building, and it was like a live wire, and somebody told us, we have to get out. So my sister, who was younger, ran out, and I was like running out, and then I was looking at my mom, who was standing there getting papers together, and I was like, I'm not leaving until you're leaving. You know, and she said, well, I have to get your birth certificates. And I was like, ah. And so but I waited for her. There was that something in me. I was like, I can't leave until she gets out. So it's that same kind of feeling. And you can easily generate it for certain people. now you're trying to spread that. Okay? So step four is called great love. Reflect on the situation of sentient beings. So you're trying to meditate and concentrate on the fact that all these beings who share this wish that you have of being happy are not able to reach complete happiness, because the happiness that we find in this world is not reliable. It's always shifting. We can never really relax into our happiness. It's always moving because we're in samsara. And so we're generating a strong feeling of love towards all these beings, wanting them to not have suffering. So now we're kind of switching from, now we're looking at all beings as our mothers, and now we're almost looking at them as our children. We're generating that kind of love for them, as though the kind of love you have for something, some creature, some being that you want to help. You want them all to receive the, you know, real, true happiness. And on top of that, determine that you yourself are going to bring all of them to this kind of happiness that they wish for. So we know that everybody wants happiness, and now you're meditating on how the happiness here is not reliable, and you want desperately for all these beings to be happy. You want all of these beings to be out of prison. You decide that you're... it's your responsibility to make this happen for yourself and for them. And then the final one is great compassion. I'm sorry, no, step five is great compassion. This is, to me, they're similar, but the first one, the great love, is really generating that love for them, that they're going to have happiness. The compassion is meditating more on the sufferings of all beings. You see that kind of distinction? So first is the great love of how much you love these beings, how much you want them to be happy, how much you want to bring them happiness. The compassion is contemplating the sufferings that every being, all these kind mother beings have, because we're all here in the same prison together. And then contemplate the kind of sufferings that all of us experience in the different realms, this realm, lower realms. Contemplate all the kind of unbearable suffering until that kind of compassion, that kind of sadness and compassion arises. And then you work on developing that overwhelming wish that they can be free from that kind of suffering. And again, determine that you yourself are going to eliminate those sufferings. And step six is called extraordinary thought. And I'm going to read this to you. Contemplate like this. It is unbearable that sentient beings are so overwhelmed by suffering and cannot have the happiness they wish for and deserve. I cannot depend on someone else to help them overcome their suffering and achieve happiness. I must do this myself. Just as it is a child's responsibility to save her parents if they're in danger, so it is my responsibility to free all mother beings from the sufferings and bring them to the great, perfect, uncontaminated happiness. There is no other way to think. Think about this again and again until it permeates your heart through and through. And step seven is generating bodhicitta. Where not only are you going to you're going to achieve the exalted state of enlightenment in order to free them. Okay, so you know, you can see how they progress one onto the other. You can see that some of them have an overlap. You can meditate on one while you're standing in some place. You know, you can do them sequentially. You might take one that's a little bit harder and meditate on it throughout the day or throughout the week. Any questions about those? or concerns, or how do you, you know, anything? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How those concepts fit in terms of, yeah, I'm responsible for myself, but this is saying that I am also responsible for everybody else, but they are also responsible for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, does everybody hear the question? Let me see if I got this right. So how does self-determination play into this? Because they're responsible for themselves as much as you are. And and say the middle part again. There was something about, so you've determined that you're going to free them. Was there some confusion in that?
I'm responsible to free myself.
I'm responsible to free myself. Okay. Mhm. Mhm. Okay. So how much is, you know, your responsibility to free yourself? How much are you responsible to free others? Yeah, it's tricky. It's tricky, and I mean, I get stopped in my head sometimes about it with like, am I enabling? And because we don't have the wisdom to really know yet, and so what we're wanting to get to that place, you know, so we can't just go from here to there. It's not going to happen. I mean, I haven't seen it. So we're going to be going all along the way. Right now, we're trying to develop even just that wish that we could get to that place where we would have the wisdom, so that if we were Buddhas, we would be able to know that, okay, what would really help this person is if I come and stand in front of them in line and act like a jerk, you know. What's really going to help this person is maybe if I just bring them this book to read, you know. What's really going to, and that ultimately, yes, everybody, you know, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas cannot just come down, descend, and bring us over to their realm. It is going to require our effort. But it's kind of like a ladder in a room. You're going to have the wish to get up, go over to that ladder and walk up it. That's going to be your self-determination. Without the ladder, though, you're not going to be able to climb anything. So I'm thinking of the ladder as like the teachings or a Buddha. And the more that you evolve and the more the closer and the more enlightened you become, then the more you'll know what's going to help each person to see that ladder or to go over to that ladder. You're not going to be able to drag them there and push them up it, right? But say we're all in prison and you find a way out, okay? You found a way out now and you come to us and you say, I found a way out of prison. It's going to be up to us to go along with that. There's going to be some people who decide not to get out, you know, and some people are going to get out later, and some people are going to be pushing you down to get out. And but there's not going to be any information you can even bring to them until you figure out how to get out. But just by you doing that, just the information that you'll have, the wisdom that you'll have. So I read this story about this man who grew up in a prison camp in North Korea, and he was born in it. So he didn't have any inkling that there's anything other than these awful guards and the pathetic prisoners. I mean, that was his whole existence until he was like a teenager or early 20s, and somebody was brought in brand new to the prison, and this person was telling him, this isn't life, this life outside of prison. He was describing food that they eat. And this was brand new information to him, and it blew his mind, and now he wanted to get out. So it's kind of like that. It's like if you've got more information than somebody else has, it's going to be stunning what that little information can do. You'll never know what effect it will have on somebody else's self-determination. And we can all think about examples like that of something small that somebody did for us that then was a huge, had a huge ripple effect. Does that make sense? So, yeah, you're not going to be, but you will be affecting people's self-determination to get out, and you'll be giving them more of the tools. And, helping them to create more merit and more wisdom so that they'll find that way out as well. It's a great question. And I think it's something we have to constantly remind ourselves, too, of like, now, how would I be able to help people? And there's this one, I'll have to try to find this one dedication where they actually go through it, of like, I'm going to dedicate this merit so that my mind becomes cleaner and clearer and sharper and I can see more. And then because of that, I'll be able to teach this and those people, you know, it goes on and on and on. And the one example that always helps me when I get stuck with this is just because growing up in this culture, this is a story that I've heard all the time, and it makes sense to me. So I didn't grow up in any formal religion, so if I get this story wrong, excuse me, but it's kind of, you'll understand my point. So that story about Jesus walking, I think, through a crowd and somebody touches his robe and they're healed. You know that story? And they touch his robe and they're healed of whatever illness they have, and Jesus turns to them because he can feel that. And the man says, "You healed me." And Jesus says, "It's your faith that healed you." I love this story because it was the conjoining of that man's faith with this other man's state of being, right? That came together. But Jesus's whatever you want to call it, his pure energy, couldn't work unless that other man had that kind of openness and faith, because if it did, then every single person who saw Jesus would feel that way and not kill him. So that's the responsibility that we have. The cleaner our minds are, the more we're going to be able to see, and the more we'll progress, and the more, you know, of course there'll be steps backward and steps upward, but that's what'll happen. And I just love that story because it kind of shows the emptiness of it all and what happens when somebody sees something a certain way, you know. Okay, any other questions? All right, so let's try this meditation. Okay, I'm going to walk you through it. Do you have a question? No? Yeah, I thought you said.
You said, are there any questions? I have so many questions. Not on this.
Oh. Oh, not on this?
Well, it is, but it's not.
Well, you sure?
Yeah.
Okay, because questions help, because otherwise it's not, you know, they do help. So, well, after this meditation, let me hear at least one of them, okay? Because then I can wind it in to something, either now or later. Okay, so get comfortable. I'm going to walk you through this meditation so that you can, you know, keep practicing this on your own. Like I said, you can take parts of it or all of it. And I'm going to, okay, so anyway, just check your posture, get comfortable, relax your breathing, feel yourself relax, but stay alert. And the preliminary stepping equanimity, some of you are familiar with this, but I'm going to go over it again in case you aren't. So imagine there's three people in front of you, and one person is a friend of yours. And just look at your friend, see how you feel, the happiness it generates, the love you have, how nice that is. And the other person is someone you're not too fond of, someone who's caused you some trouble. Someone you're having difficulty with or have had difficulty with, and take a look at them and notice how that feels. And then the third person is someone you don't know, complete stranger, or, you know, barely. You know them, you've seen them here and there maybe, but you have no feelings one way or the other. Negative or positive, just take a look at them and see how that feels. And then with the stranger, think about what they could do that would put them in the friend category. What actions they would take, things they would say, experiences you would have that would make you consider them a friend. And then think about what they could do or say that would make you consider them an enemy or someone who you don't like. And then do the same thing with your friend. Is there something that they could do that would make you less fond of them? Make you not want to be around them? And then same thing with the enemy. Is there something they could do that would make you feel more fondly towards them? And like this, we see how fluid these categories are. And how many different types of relationships we have. And how each of these beings and categories, what we have in common with each of them is our wish to be happy and our wish to avoid suffering. So trying now to just blur the lines between friend, enemy, and stranger, and just seeing them all as beings wanting happiness, and that our attitude is the thing that shifts. And now meditate for a little while on the continuity of your own mind, that your own mind stream has existed since beginningless time, countless lifetimes in the past, and it will move forward into the future. And that in each of these lifetimes, there's been a mother who gave birth to you. Each of these lifetimes, no matter what kind of being you were, there was a mother. So it's impossible to say which of the beings now were your mother in the past. And if we're looking at countless, countless, countless time, even beyond the history of this earth, then all beings at one point have been your mother. So contemplate this until you generate a feeling in your heart that there isn't even one being who hasn't been your mother in the past. Or if it's easier than one being who hasn't been connected to you in a very loving way in the past. And now contemplate on the depth of your own mother's kindness. So think about your mother who carried you for 9 months. And contemplate the way that she took care of you. If it's easy to think about one specific time in your life, like I did when I was 9, or if it's easier to think about your whole lifespan, whatever it is, just take a moment to really think about the details of that care. When you were sick, when you couldn't move as an infant, making sure you were educated. Helping you become a decent person. And think about your inner qualities that you have, the positive qualities that you have, and how these are also due to the kindness of your mother. And that these things are not true just for the mother in this life, but in for all those lifetimes that you just identified. and that all those lifetimes have been like a wave moving you forward to right where you are at this moment. Almost as if we are a receptacle and our mothers is pouring all this energy and love into us. And now, having gained an understanding of the kindness of mother beings, contemplate how important it is to repay that kindness. And what is the best way to repay this kindness? There's lots of ways to repay it. But think about if the best way, what's the very best way? Again, if you can generate the understanding that where we are is analogous to a prison, then is repaying the kindness to help them out, to liberating mother beings from the same prison. And then the next step is to generate strong, loving attitude towards all beings. The same kind of love that a mother feels towards her children. Same wish for beings to be happy. It may be just remembering how it makes you feel to see someone you love happy, then trying to expand this so that you wish all beings would feel this happiness. And again, to contemplate this and try to expand this wish for their happiness, how wonderful it makes us feel to see others happy. So we generate that strong wish that all beings are happy. And now on top of that, we generate a compassion for them, understanding the sufferings of this world, of this samsaric prison, that the happiness that we find here can turn to unhappiness, that it's not reliable. The amount of suffering that our mother beings and we experience here. We just reflect on these realities until a deep feeling of compassion for ourselves and for them arises, and the wish that all of us could be completely free of this. What an amazing thing it would be if we did not experience these sufferings. And then we contemplate that it is unbearable that beings are overwhelmed with suffering and cannot have the happiness they wish for and deserve. I can't wait for somebody else to help us out of this prison. I will do this. I will find the way out. I'm going to work to find the way out so that I can show others the same way. And finally, the contemplation that the only real and true benefit that I can give to others, to these other mother beings, is to completely take away their sufferings and to bring them to true and everlasting happiness. This means becoming enlightened for the sake of others. In my current state, I am still controlled by delusion and karma. I cannot even liberate myself, much less others. The only way I can become able to enlighten other beings is to become enlightened myself first. So for the sole purpose of liberating all other beings from suffering and leading them to complete perfect enlightenment, I must as quickly as possible achieve the exalted state of supreme enlightenment. Okay. And slowly open your eyes when you're ready. Any thoughts or questions or stumbling blocks or...
I've heard people say that other people are much more important.
Okay.
It's on. It doesn't work.
Yeah, I think it's on enough.
And I had to remember what my father said, who was in war. He said, out of 9 soldiers, before they die, call for their mother.
Ah.
So for a human being, the mother is the most important person.
Right.
We just are not aware of it all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, we're just not aware of it all the time. Yeah. Yeah.
I think somebody else or something else is more important.
Right. But in that moment of need, you know, yeah.
Yeah, it must be so strong that mm-hmm. for that moment, they mm-hmm. come out. And he said almost everybody did. It was terrible.
Could everybody hear what she's saying? Cause yeah, no, okay. What she was saying is that she's heard some people say that mother's not that important. Tell me if I get this right, you know. But her father during the war was saying that when he saw people dying, was around them as they were dying in the war, that at that moment of their death they were calling out for their mother, and how just we might not recognize the importance of the mother because it's just kind of like the air around us, but at that moment of great need, you know, when we get sick, you know, oftentimes that's what happens too. It's like, I remember when you first leave home and you're feeling all kind of independent, and then you get sick and it's like, oh, mom, you know. So it is very, very powerful. So it's that kind of feeling we're trying to generate towards all. And you know, again, you always have to remember that all these meditations, they're very skillful ways of changing and training our mind. You know, that's what they're designed to do. So it's picking the mother for a reason, you know, and then if it doesn't work for somebody else, then pick somebody else. Pick the person that is going to make you have that kind of feeling of love and compassion and determination. That's what it's trying to do. Does this get at what some of your questions about determination, or did that come up more? Okay.
I had one other question.
Yeah.
Does this work now?
It is working enough. Yeah, you have to hold it really close.
Okay. You said everybody should try to get enlightened. I always had the impression that enlightenment means you go into nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a long way before you get into nirvana. Is that correct? From what you said now. So people can be enlightened and still continue living in this world.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So this gets into all these kind of complicated little diagrams. I mean, nirvana, there's parinirvana, there's complete enlightenment. But, so there's a couple different questions you have. But yes, so a Buddha who's completely enlightened can choose to come and manifest here so that you and I can see him or her. But not all the Buddhas are showing up physically like that. There's a different kind of what they call Buddha bodies, and some of them are ones that we could see. And so we wouldn't be able to know. I couldn't say, you've got 10 more lifetimes and then you're enlightened. You've got 10 more eons. And then, yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. You know, there's no way to know how close somebody is.
Enlightenment, the end of the existence on the world? Is enlightenment the same as Buddhahood?
Yes. Okay. Enlightenment is the same as Buddhahood. It doesn't necessarily mean it's the end of existence on this earth, but it would mean the end of uncontrolled returning to the samsaric realms. And it's not someplace else we would go. It's, you know, enlightenment is through our body, speech, and mind. And so we have, you know, we have body, speech, and mind. Those are the things that become enlightened. But then we have choices, and it's not right now. It's all uncontrollable rebirth. We can't really, you know, it's just we are the subjects of our karma, of the seeds that we've planted before. Once you have escaped that, because of your actions, you've developed your mind to the point where you're no longer the kind of the victim of those, that karmic cycle. Make sense? Okay. Anything else? Yeah.
During that meditation, and we've done the meditation a few times where you focus on someone you love, someone who's an enemy you dislike, and someone who's indifferent. I have a lot of trouble with the meditation. I dislike it greatly. I don't enjoy thinking about the person, my enemy. And I'm curious why we want to think of something negative like that, and how do you overcome those negative feelings? Is it sort of like in the same sense of facing your fear to overcome your fear? Mm-hmm. You keep thinking about that person that you dislike, mm-hmm. so that feeling maybe becomes dull or not mm-hmm. as strong. Or I don't enjoy it at all, and we keep doing it. So I'm just trying to understand how I can stop feeling that way.
Okay,
because I understand. Stand trying to, you know, the person that you care for, they could do something to that maybe you began to dislike them. But mm-hmm. I have a lot of trouble finding something that the person that I dislike uh-huh. could do something uh-huh. that I don't have those feelings towards them.
Yeah, maybe you need to start with a milder enemy first. the point of the meditation is to show how those categories can change. So even the person that we dislike, if they, you know, apologized and did X, Y, and Z, then maybe there would be like a little detente and they wouldn't become our complete enemy. It might be easier, just as I say all this, it might be easier to make it less personal and think about even historically two historic enemies. Two countries that were like, you know, really, you know, had a difficult history. And then through history, things changed. What changed? You know, what changed there that now made them, you know, able to at least neighbors? Now they may not be best allies, but at least they're neighbors and they're not at war. That's the whole purpose, is to see the impermanence of those categories. We think those categories kind of exist outside of us, but that they're actual, that they're not. That they're very fluid, and because of that, then it helps us to see people in a different kind of way. You know, that it's another way to do it is to look at somebody that you don't like, or even again a historical figure it could be, and know that other people do like that person. That person could, even Hitler was probably kind to a kitten or a child or something. You know, and so that nothing is so rooted and fixed like that. But I would say then, yeah, try it with like a country. I was just watching this whole show on Croatia and Serbia, and it was very interesting. And to see, you know, what they went through and now where they are, it was this exact meditation. You know, I mean, you could see, though, it could devolve to that, or it could go into something really positive. And that's what we're trying to see, is that it could go like this, it could go like this. But there's other meditations on generating, it's not about looking at your enemy and kind of dulling that feeling. There's other meditations to do that, but this one is more about just seeing that those aren't hard and fast categories. But I also think it's also easy. I mean, in some ways, developing equanimity, the exercise for that really is though looking at each kind of being and seeing that they want happiness. And so, like, I've just gone through something difficult with some people in my family who are doing something really kind of unethical and repulsive. And it was a real challenge for me because it's bad what they did. And I had to kind of go back, get away from it, and look at it and see even this awful thing that they did was still coming from this place of their wanting happiness. They went around it the wrong way. It doesn't mean that everybody's doing good things to try to get happiness. They're doing very misguided things and things that are creating incredible suffering for other people. But that still underneath it, somewhere, their misguided actions were generated by, oh, this is going to be good. This is going to bring me something good. You know, and then off they went into this blunder. So that's the other way of making, that's the whole point of the exercise on equanimity, is to then go focus on that, you know, that's what we have in common. Yeah. Anything else? These are great questions. Okay, so we are going to call it a night in a minute. Next week, in the next 2 weeks, Venerable Rabina will be here. There'll probably be a whole lot of other people here because she'll be teaching during the weekend, so she'll probably draw quite a crowd. So come early. And I'm not here next week because I'm in New Orleans, so several people have volunteered to set up the water bowls and such, and she may ask you. I'm going to send her an email about what we have covered so far. So she's going to pick it up, and I'm going to ask her to cover some of the giving and taking, which is that second kind of lineage of teachings on bodhicitta, and that's like Tonglen and other ways of practicing giving and taking, that are the other methods of practicing bodhicitta. In the meantime, please excuse me, read the next two articles. They're fairly short. And there's, you know, if you have more interest in this, there's so many things you can read, and and they're not going to hurt. So The Way of a Bodhisattva is really wonderful text by Shantideva, and it's written like a long poem, and it's divided into wonderful categories, all on the six perfections.
Is that the same as the Bodhisattva's
Guide to a Way of Life? Bodhisattva Guide? Yeah. They're different. This, I think this is an old version. You won't even see this cover in the bookstore anymore. I think it's red now. Yeah, there's two different kind of translations of it. Anything else before we call it a night? Okay, so yeah, and your homework is more notes from the field. You know, whether it's watching a show or, you know, standing in a long line. But it's almost like there isn't a situation that comes up where you can't find something in this topic. It's just really hard to find something that doesn't fit. So bring in notes, and next time when I'm back, we'll be in some small groups so we can start processing some of this as well. Okay, so let's take a minute to dedicate, because so like any time I hear a train, I try to stop and think about like bodhicitta. You know, just little markers throughout the day. So I'm like trying to, so it's not just Monday night or not just when I open a book, that it, you know, just little things that remind me of that. Okay, so we just created a whole lot of positive merit, positive seeds by coming here on a Monday night. And as Geshe-la always tells me, just think about how many other people in North Carolina are spending Monday night thinking about this. And not very many. So really, you know, congratulate yourself. There's nothing wrong with congratulating yourself on the effort that you took to come here and think and share and listen. It will result in something. And so when we dedicate, we are directing where we want those seeds to grow. And think about the obstacles between you and complete enlightenment, and may the merit that you just created by coming here or listening at home or wherever you are, that this merit, may it ripen so that your path to complete enlightenment is as swift as possible, that you may help all those around you. And take a minute to think about something tomorrow that you would like to be able to do with more of a bodhisattva attitude, whether it's somebody at work, something at home, just one thing that you would like to be able to remember and recall and make a strong wish to be able to do so.